Good afternoon. So, last time we finished up talking about our basic scheduling metrics. So we talked about throughput, which is sort of how much time we spent running actual programs, not running scheduling related things. Talked about turnaround time, sort of, which is, you know, how long it takes from when something's ready to run to when it finishes. It's kind of a proxy for how responsive, how interactive is the system, though maybe it doesn't agree with all our notions of that, because if we're talking about like total turnaround time or mean turnaround time, we're kind of weighting every program equally no matter what things it ends up waiting for, whether that's user input or disk or whatever. We also mentioned fairness. And then we looked at some scheduling algorithms concretely. And we started with the simplest ones. So first come, first serve is basically my scheduling algorithm is whenever I need to do something else, get the next thing on the list. And only do it when I need to, so I'm not stopping programs while they're running. I'm only stopping programs because the program doesn't have anything more to do right now. Then I talked about round robin, saying, okay, so maybe we don't want to, you know, only stop the program when it has nothing more to do. So what we'll do is we'll just stop running it after some time quantum expires. So we'll set some timer when the program starts or earlier, and when that timer expires, we'll switch to another program. And the choice of this timer, well, there's a trade-off there. If we make the time quantums, the amount of time we let a program run before we stop it, if it still wants to run, we make that really long, well, we have lower overhead and therefore higher throughput. There's less context switches, less time spent scheduling, less overhead from needing to have our caches be filled with some other program and then switching to a program that's not in the cache right now. Make it shorter, it's probably more fair. That, you know, we saw that with first come, first served, which is kind of, you know, if we set our time quantum infinitely long, then whatever program happens to be first gets to run a lot better than everything else. And making our time quantum shorter gets rid of that difference. And when we were looking at first come, first serve, it was kind of an accident in the cases we looked at, you know, what thing came first. You mentioned, well, in practice, we need to decide what time quantum to choose. And, well, we started with it in round robin, but we're going to have a similar decision with lots of other schedulers because there's a lot of times we're going to want to run something, but not for too long. You choose how much is too long. And a typical choice you'll see in practice is somewhere between 1 and 100 milliseconds. And sort of the empirical decision we're making here is that there's some cost to every context switch. And most of that cost I mentioned was not actually the cost of like saving the registers and so on, but the cost of all the cache misses we're going to have because our L1 cache and so on in our processor are not going to have the data for the thing we're switching to. And empirically, that ends up being like a tenth to a hundredth of a millisecond. But, you know, this varies a lot because, well, it depends on how the programs are using caches a whole bunch, and also the processor and so on. And we just choose a time that makes us not too annoyed by that overhead, basically. Then, after we looked at our time quantum trade-off, we learned, well, we can deal with throughput and fairness in some way with this time quantum choice, but we talked about turnaround time as a metric, and well, we wanted to optimize that. What can we do about that? And we learned that the sort of key idea was we want to run shorter things first, that if multiple things can run, if we run the shortest one, then everyone else is going to wait the least amount of time for that shortest one to finish. Then we had a diversion into some other scheduling algorithms, which we'll go back to shortest things first later. We talked about priority scheduling. So we said, you know, let's talk about different goals. So let's say I'm a system administrator and, you know, I say some users are more important than others. I want their programs to run better. I can use this priority scheduling idea where we assign every program a priority, and our scheduling algorithm is we always run the thing with the highest priority we can, including, you know, stopping running something with a lower priority if something else comes along. And we learned that, you know, that works, that it'll achieve that goal, but it really achieves that goal so much that we might regret it. We have this problem of starvation, that quite often know, even if, you know, it's not your design, you're going to end up with a case where, because they're things at a higher priority, you'll never or almost never run a thing at a lower priority, and it will never make any progress. Then we looked at sort of the different goals. So priority scheduling was sort of, we have, you know, one thing's more important than the other. We're going to make that the first thing we do. We looked at coming from a different direction. Let's start with fairness being the first thing we do. And we talked about, well, a simple fair algorithm is choose what to run randomly. And we can kind of modify that to allow us to have some preferences. And this gave us this proportional share scheduling idea that we're going to, you know, if something's twice as important, let's run it twice as often. And we had this simple idea with this lottery scheduling algorithm where we make a random choice and we weight that random choice based on how important things are to us. And this gives us sort of, like the priority scheduling algorithm, it lets us make a policy decision about what programs are more important than the others and apply that in our scheduler. And it does it in a way which is more flexible than the priority way, because we can kind of, you know, do something that's other than a binary, run this instead of this decision. We can give that sort of trade-off. I'll finish up talking about that next, but before I go into that, questions about things we covered last time or other things from last week? Yes?
If there's like an issue with like cache, misses, why not in the context switch also just save what's in the cache?
Question, if there's an issue with cache misses, why not in the context switch just save what's in the cache? So I guess there are two issues with that. So one, probably the biggest practical issue, is that usually processors do not have an interface to do that. The second is that it's not clear that the things we save would actually be helpful, right? Because some of the stuff that's in the cache we won't actually use. And that's going to take a lot of time. And it's not clear that it's actually going to be faster than just running something to bring the stuff into the cache, right? So I don't think there's a clear, like, I could imagine trying it, but I would be surprised if it was beneficial compared to just letting cache misses happen and load the things into the cache that way. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay, anything? Okay. PM lecture, we don't want to go over the quiz, apparently. Okay. Which is fine, because I wrote explanations for a reason. So let's go back to lottery scheduling. So I mentioned sort of our key algorithm is that when we want to make a scheduling decision, we assign some number, we have some number of tickets that are assigned, like by our system administrator or some other algorithm, to each thread. And we just do a lottery among the threads where we basically, you know, give each process a range of ticket numbers. We take a random number, and we choose a random number to find the win. And the way we're going to have you implement this is we're going to be okay with this being linear time. If we wanted to implement this efficiently, we want some quick way of, like, updating this set of ranges as, like, threads become ready or not ready. And, you know, that's done. We're not going to worry about that. We're just going to, you know, say we just go through all of them and do this lottery process. And sort of, you can just iterate through all the threads we could possibly want. And I mentioned that, well, you know, we can use this to simulate priority. So this can get arbitrarily close to a priority schedule. In this case, the way I do it is I say highest priority will give 1,000,000 tickets, second highest will give 1,000 tickets, and lowest will give 1 ticket. So this isn't priority, because this is, you know, the thing at this medium priority can run 1/1,000th of the time that the thing at the highest priority runs on average over time. So it's not a strict priority, but it's very close. And we can make it closer by making this ratio instead of like 1,000,000 and 1,000. We can make it, you know, 1,000,000,000 and 1,000. We can make it less of a benefit from priority and closer, more fair, you know, less possibility of starvation by making the ratio less. So it gives us kind of this knob to go between sort of equal round robin type schedule and a strict priority schedule. And to choose that, we just have something that assigns these numbers of tickets accordingly, depending on where we want to be on that scale. So that's sort of a very attractive thing about this lottery policy, is that we can, depending, but just by setting these numbers correctly, we can implement a lot of different, lottery mechanism, we can implement a lot of different policy. We just choose these numbers to based on what we actually want to do. And there's a lot of things that can happen, and it's done in a way where we're very likely to avoid that starvation issue we saw with priority scheduling. Or at least have a straightforward way of avoiding starvation, where with priority scheduling, if you're worried about starvation, that's going to be a lot of extra work in setting the priorities to make sure that doesn't happen. So typically what people who have things based on priority scheduling will do about starvation is that they'll have to adjust the priority of something that's really low priority if it doesn't run for a while. And we don't have to do that sort of thing in this scheme. So questions about sort of lottery scheduling? It's a mechanic before I talk about specifically what we're doing in the assignment. Yes? Sorry? Are tickets consumed? No. So the model is that every time we run this auction, we're gonna run it from scratch. That's what we're gonna implement. So there's probably an observation to make that maybe we should do some adjustment based on whether you're currently running or something like that. We're not gonna worry about that for the assignment, but that might be something you do sort of in a real version of this. Other questions? Okay. So in the assignment, we're going to have you add this to XV6. We need some way of setting number of tickets. We're going to have it just be something that's set by programs. So you're going to add a system call called setTickets that will set the number of tickets. And one thing we need to actually test this is we need to know what the scheduler is doing. XV6 doesn't really tell you, right? It just runs things. So you're going to need to add, as part of the assignment, things to track how often threads are scheduled, so we can actually figure out, are you scheduling things differently or not? Otherwise, it's really hard to tell. There's some things I'm going to point out you don't need to do. So it's okay if your scheduling decisions are linear time. It's okay that you can, that every time you need to figure out what to run, you iterate through all the processes, all the threads, even though, yes, there's a way of not doing that. But this is not a class on how to make tree data structures that track ranges. It's an interesting topic, but not for this class. So I'm not going to have you do that or debug that. Also, something that people who propose this sort of scheme worry about is, what about something that doesn't use its whole time slice? We want to do some sort of compensation for that. We're not going to worry about that. We're only going to schedule when the scheduler would run normally. Even though in practice, if you want to have this proportional share actually happen, you want to do something special for a program that never uses its whole time slice. But we're just not going to try to account for that. And this was originally proposed by academics in 1994, and they had a lot of extra details that we're not worried about having. They talked about how do you maintain that data structure so you can do those lotteries fast. How do you make preemption decisions with this? So how do you run a new lottery when something becomes runnable in the middle of something else? Because if we think about simulating priority, right, we really actually want it to be the case that when something with a million tickets comes along, that it probably gets to run. And they had a scheme for making that happen. We're not going to worry about that. We're just going to say, sorry, it has to wait till the end of the time quantum. They also talked about how do we deal with scheduling things like, say, network time or disk space or something like that. They have mechanisms for dealing with that. And it's a really nice thing for academics. It's really elegant. It can implement a lot of policies. We can extend it to deal with all sorts of different resources. And you might say, so does anyone use it? No. Pretty much no. It's not really used commercially, and there's probably some good reasons for that. So there's a scheme that is arguably related, we'll talk about, that Linux uses, but from a high level, it makes some very different decisions, and I think it's because of one issue. And talk about here. So let's say, doing a lottery scheduling, and I have thread A, it has one ticket, And thread B has 9 tickets, and they're both always runnable. And what this means is there's 10 tickets total, so every time we do those auctions, A should run 1/10 of the time, and B should run 9/10 of the time. So A should get 10% of the CPU, and B should get 90%, you know, excluding, you know, context switch time and so on. So over 10 time quantum, my question is, what is the probability that A runs for at least 3 of those? So what's the probability that instead of getting 10% of the CPU, we sample 10 time units, it gets 30%? Give you a minute. And yeah, I only need an approximate answer because we're not going to worry about lots of decimal points. Okay, who'd like some more time? People. Someone want to share an approximate answer? Yes. So I say 120 out of 1,000. So how did you get that? Okay. So there's 3 to 10 ways of doing this. We have 10 items, and 3 of them are going to be A. Yeah. So, okay, so you say there's a 1 over 10 cube chance. So that's not quite right, but close. So there's a 1 over 10 cube chance. This is the chance of choose A 3 times. We also need to choose B 3 times if we're calculating B, 7 times. So we need 9 over 10 to the 7th, and this is the exactly 3. And then you need to do something similar to get exactly 4, and so on. So not quite, and which means the number you have is a little high. So with this correction factor here, this, you know, 9 over 10 to the 7th, the exactly 3 number ends up being about 5.6%. And doing this for 4, 5, and 6 get us to about 7. So exactly 3 plus 4 equals 4%. This equals 5%, and so on. And the basic, and the, you know, the probability binomial theorem, so not a binomial distribution, if you remember that from probability. If you've taken probability, I know not everyone has, which is why this is definitely not on the quiz. So it's binomial distribution. We're doing a sum over it. But we get about 7%. And that's, you know, so that's like more than 1 out of 20 times. If we look at a small time period, it turns out that A doesn't really run a tenth of the time. Not even close. And, you know, if we're thinking of, well, is that bad? Well, if like, if 10 time quantum is like half a second, that's going to be some noticeable jitter in your interactive performance. Like how much B, if something you're working with, gets to run. And if we look at this distribution, we do the same logic, we can say, what about, what's the chance that A runs 0 times? Well, that's 9 over 10 to the 10th. One way of doing that, and that gives us about 34% of the time. So it turns out over a short period of time, there's a lot of variation. That's just how the random process works. So we're making this independent random decision each time. And if we're thinking about the long term, that's not a big deal, right? This will average out over time. Because yes, sometimes we'll choose 0, sometimes we'll get it to run 3 times, and that'll average out in the long term. But the problem is often we do actually care what happens in the short term. It's not really nice to have a system which whose performance varies a lot. And that's what this sort of policy might end up doing over the short term. And that's what I would guess not many people have tried to implement these sorts of algorithms in commercial operating systems. Just because even though the idea is really elegant, it doesn't really work out so great. Now, if you do like this algorithm but don't like the randomness, these same people had a follow-up paper where they did a deterministic version of this, where rather than making a random choice, we do something where we do something like round robin. We take turns, but in a way that deals with those weights, or those, you know, those shares. That has a lot more bookkeeping, like a way a lot more bookkeeping. So we're not going to teach it, but it's out there, and that's probably what you'd actually implement. And we'll talk about a Linux scheduler that's kind of in that family of algorithms. So questions about our variation from lottery scheduling. But academics, they really like lottery scheduling because, you know, although there is that more complicated algorithm that's deterministic and, you know, nice and even, you know, lottery scheduling, the other big nice thing is that there's very little bookkeeping, right? We don't actually need to maintain information besides the number of tickets, basically, which is, you know, a lot less than many other scheduling algorithms, especially at the time that this was proposed, where, yes, we're not going to probably talk about many commercial OS schedulers from the mid-90s, but a lot of them weren't great. Okay, so we talked a bit about priority scheduling and proportional share. Now we're going to try going back to talking about our minimizing turnaround time. And, you know, we mentioned that, oh, the way we do that is we run the shortest thing first. So this seems like this is just priority scheduling. We just set the priorities based on CPU burst length, right? Priority, just set it based on the CPU burst length. And we'll start by looking at how this works without preemption. Then we'll add preemption. We'll see that the most straightforward approach has a little nit that we have to deal with when we add preemption. Preemption meaning that if something becomes runnable while something else is running, do we switch to that? That, you know, even though we talked that was straightforward to do for priority scheduling, if we do the straightforward thing where we just set those priorities up in advance, it won't work quite right. We have to adjust the priorities, and we'll see why. Now, there's a problem I'm going to talk about later, which is we need to know what CPU burst lengths thread have. I'm going to just, for now, we're going to tell you. We know the thread's pattern looks like, you know, this has this CPU burst length. We'll deal with this problem later a bit, maybe, sort of. We're not going to really solve it, but we're going to do the best we can. So for now, let's assume we know what our programs do, and we have these programs which do a CPU burst, followed by IO, followed by CPU burst. So this is our pattern. And if we're thinking about applying that priority scheduling idea here, we want to have program B at the highest priority, program C at the middle priority, and program A at the lowest priority. So without preemption, we get a schedule that looks like this. In this case, the arrows represent it goes down when we start waiting for IO and it comes back up when we finish. So this period here is represented by this line here. And you see that what we're doing is when we have multiple things to run, we choose between the different things based on their priority. So in this case, after A finishes, we have both B and C ready. We run B first because it's the highest priority. So questions about this? Yes?
If you add up all the arrows for each individual program, do you get a turnaround time?
So if I follow the arrows for each individual program, do I get what? Do I get the turnaround time? So the turnaround time is from the arrow tip, arrow head, to when it goes to the starts the next IO, which is when the next arrow starts going down. Does that answer your question? Okay. So you can see that this is our following that, and you can see that this makes the case that we really do need preemption here. That we're not going to have a satisfying approximation of minimizing turnaround time without doing some preemption, because we'll have that convoy effect I talked about with first come, first served. That just naturally, things that have short CPU bursts will finish in the middle of something with a long CPU burst, which is very likely to happen because it's a long CPU burst. Things are likely to finish during a long amount of time versus a short one, and they'll end up waiting in a long line and being delayed a lot. So it seems like, well, what the thing to do is just run the thing with the highest priority. So like right here, in this place where the convoying has happened, well, run program B right away rather than letting program A continue. And then run program C right away rather than letting program A continue. And that idea, you know, it works here, but there's going to be a corner case where it's going to be wrong. It's not going to actually minimize our turnaround time. So the case where it works is we have this long thing running, and a short job comes in, you know, becomes ready in the middle. Run the short job right away. Great. The case where it doesn't work is where the long job is almost done, and something interrupts it that would take longer than it would take to finish. We would rather wait, have the long job finish if it's almost done, than actually start the other thing now. If we think about turnaround time, you know, we're gonna have the long job is gonna wait for longer for that medium thing than the short amount of time it would need to finish, compared to how much we're delaying the medium thing, which is a short amount of time, all that the job needs to finish. So to show a concrete example of that, say right here, this is, I could run C there, but I don't want to, because if I run C right there, then A is going to be delayed by a long time, relatively speaking, compared to how long it will take to finish. I really want to finish A instead of switching right to C. So what we want to do is, rather than setting our priority statically, where we say A is lowest, B is highest, C is middle, we want to set our priorities based on the current remaining time in the CPU burst. So they're going to change depending on the remaining time. So this is unfortunately a bunch more work for us. We have these dynamically changing priorities, but that's going to achieve, you know, our actual minimizing turnaround time. So we're prioritizing by the time that's left, not the total in general. Yes? Does the remaining time include your FIO? By remaining time, I mean the remaining time in the CPU burst.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're only scheduling CPU bursts. Like, that's our setup. Other questions? Okay, so you can see our example here, you know, where typically, you know, in this case, A had more time, had less time left than B would take, so B got to RAN. Even though A is mostly done, it's not enough mostly done compared to how close B is to done. Here, you know, we waited for A to finish because it had less stuff to finish than C would have to run, and so on. So this gives us what I'll call shortest remaining time first, which is sort of the preemptive version of shortest job first. And if you do some mathematical models, and you try to sort of figure out the optimal schedule, if you ignore context switch costs, you can show that on a single core, single job, shortest job first, without preemption, is the best you can do without preemption, assuming you don't just leave the CPU idle. So why would leaving the CPU idle help? Because if you just say, oh, rather than running A right now, I'm going to wait for C to finish. But assuming we don't do that, assuming we say, if I can run something, I'm going to run it, shortest job first is the best you can do without preemption. And with preemption, the shortest remaining time first is the best you can do. Under the assumption context, which is take no time, and we have one core. Now, these are nice mathematical results. They're maybe not so useful because these schedulers still depends on us knowing exactly how long CPU bursts are. In addition to the issue of context switch overhead probably mattering, but it depends on exactly how long CPU bursts are, which we can't possibly know. Questions about two schedulers overall? And just a brief note on names. I'm going to say use SRTF for the preemptive algorithm with remaining time, and SJF for the non-preemptive one. You might see SJF being used for both of these, depending on context in books or something like that, just to let you know. So you might say SJF referring to preemptive with remaining time. Yes? Can you still run into problems with starvation? Absolutely. Because the point is that we don't run things with long remaining times. Things with long remaining times might absolutely never get to run if there's enough stuff with short remaining times. And that is by design, because that is how you minimize turnaround time. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we have a theoretical scheduler, so let's talk about making it a real scheduler. And what we needed to know is we need to know how long the CPU burst is so we can compute that time, you know, estimate. And in some contexts, you can ask. So some batch scheduling system, so like if I have, there's some big share computer and I'm running a weather simulation on it, I might say, this is going to take 2 hours. In that case, great. I've told you it takes 2 hours. You can run this policy with 2 hours. Usually, we don't have that sort of information. We have no actual information about how long things will run. And we need to make some guesses. And, you know, the first thing I might say is, okay, so let's say I'm adding this to XV6. Let's try to look at our process control block to see if there's any information for my scheduler here that would help me figure out, is it short or long? And there's stuff where I might be able to make some sort of guess, but there's very poor information. Like, I can maybe guess if it has uses a lot of memory, maybe it's more likely to be short or more likely to be long. If it has certain files open, maybe it's more likely to be short or more likely to be long. But I can only make the roughest of guesses from this information. So that tells me I need to collect something that's not here. And if I want to know the length of that CPU burst, I want to guess it. To get a good guess, there's something that we're not collecting I need to know. And we could just run the program to figure it out, but you know, we'd rather not do that. So we're going to have some heuristics, meaning guesses, that don't always work to figure it out. And the key heuristic that operating systems use for this is that the CPU bursts a thread makes now are likely to be similar to the ones it will make sometime later, sometime shortly later. So that means if I measure some CPU bursts of the program, I can use that to predict its future CPU bursts. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to try to, you know, look at what the program does and record that in some way in our future. And there's lots of options for doing this, taking advantage of this key insight where we monitor the program, record that information in some way, and use that to implement our scheduling algorithm, where we basically say, here's our time estimate, now we can do SRTF on estimates, so it's not going to be real SRTF, but it's going to be close. So as a concrete example of this idea, I'm going to talk about one scheme that's been commonly used with some additional details to make it practical that does this estimating, and it does this in a particularly elegant way based on priority scheduling. And you know, some annoyance about that idea of like estimating CPU bursts from prior ones is that like it's a lot of bookkeeping. You know, we want to not do that much work on scheduling. And there's a key insight that makes this bookkeeping simpler, that we can kind of couple our tracking of the priority of a thread with a tracking of its current time estimate. Because things with a short time estimate should have higher priority. So rather than like tracking the time estimate and updating that, we'll just update the priority based on our time estimate guess. So we're going to have a scheme. And I'm going to show just one version of the scheme, which this general category is known as multi-level feedback queues in the cutoff part of the slide up there. There's lots of variations out there, so I'm just showing you one version. You might read other versions, but the key insight is that we're going to use priorities to track our estimate of CPU burst length. So what I'm going to want to do, basically, is I want to set things up so my highest priority represents programs with a short CPU burst. My lowest priority represents programs with long CPU bursts. I want to update where programs are in these priorities based on my guess about their CPU bursts. And how am I going to get information about their CPU bursts? Well, I look at how long they run. So if a program at priority 3 runs for more than a millisecond, I know I made a mistake. It shouldn't be at priority 3. I should move it to a lower priority. If a program at priority 0 runs for less than a millisecond, I know I made a mistake. It probably should be at a higher priority. So if that's how I'm going to update this information, look at what my current estimate is when the program finishes running and say, does it look like it's in the right place? And if not, I'll move it to a different priority. Questions about this? Yeah.
There's still timer interrupts in this?
So is there still timer interrupts? So I'll get to next the part where we'll deal with recording the amount of time the program runs, and it'll be clear what we're doing then. But there, with this setup, there's multiple options for how we might measure that time so far. But we'll have a particular choice we're going to make, which I'll show you next. Yes? How do I set the initial priority? So we have basically two, so there's a couple options we have, right? And they're probably all defensible. So one thing we can do is we could put it at the bottom, right? We could say, at the bottom. The advantage of that is, well, it's not going to interfere with anything. The disadvantage is that it's going to be a while before we run it no matter what. We could also like try to make some intelligent guess and put it in the middle. Typically, what's done is we put it at the top. And you'll see that we're going to very quickly figure out that it doesn't belong there, which is why that's going to be okay. So if it's not supposed to be at priority 3, we'll figure that out relatively quickly. And the intuition for why we can do that, well, we only need a millisecond to figure out it's not in the right place. That's typically where we'll start things, even though, you know, there are other options which are perfectly fine. Other questions? Okay. So I mentioned this idea that the priority levels reflect our CPU burst length. So how do we couple that with, like, actually measuring that and making the adjustments? And what we'll do is we'll set a time quantum at each priority that corresponds in some way to that CPU burst length. I'm not saying this exactly corresponds, but so we'll say, for example, at priority 3, you get a 1 millisecond time quantum. And that means that we're going to do something like round robin, and so when we start you, we're going to look at, you know, we're going to set a timer for 1 millisecond later, basically. And we're going to have a different time quantum at each priority corresponding to how long we think your CPU burst is supposed to be. And then we're going to, when we need to run something, we're going to choose the highest priority thing. So in this example, it would be thread A. And we're going to see, does it use its whole time slice or not? And if it uses the whole time slice, well, our guess is going to be maybe it's at too high a priority. We should move it down. Let's say it doesn't use the whole time slice. Our guess is going to be maybe it's at too low a priority. Let's move it up. And you might say, what about keeping it the same? So to keep this simple, I've just decided to have only two options. There's extension of this where we might keep it the same. But the simplest thing is we just go either up or down. And you might say, doesn't this not stabilize? Well, we're just going to oscillate. So we're going to go between like 3 and 2 or 2 and 1, something like that, if it's in the middle between the two numbers, and that's fine. So you make so we use the time quantum to, you know, check how if it runs too long, and we have to have the time quantum anyways because we don't want to keep running it forever. And this also means that if we guess something has has really high priority and we're wrong, we'll figure it out quickly. Only take us a millisecond to demote it and run something else that is the highest priority. Yes? What? How do we assign the priorities? So the typical way we'd implement this scheme is we'd have like a ready queue for each priority level. How before we run the program? So typically, as I mentioned, when a program starts, we'll put it in the queue for priority, in this case 3, and let it go up and down by these rules. And basically, when a program's runnable, it will be on one of these queues. When it's not runnable, remember what queue we want to put it on when it becomes runnable again. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. Isn't this still extremely sparential starvation? Yes. This is not solving the starvation problem, it's minimizing turnaround time. We're trying to. Other questions? So that's our multi-level feedback queue. Higher priority is a shorter time quantum before it's interrupted, and we adjust the priority and the time slice based on what happened the last time. And I showed you the simple scheme where we just always go up or down. You can do lots of variations on that, but the key idea is you control how long you run it based on your estimate. So if it runs for too long, you run something else rather than letting it run forever. And you make sure your estimate, you know, is reflected as the priority level. So this means that if our programs are consistent, they always end up at the right priority level or approximately there. Questions? Yes. Some programs have varying behavior. Yes. So some programs are going to have like a long CPU burst and a short one, and in this case, they'll fluctuate in their priorities, and you know, it's going to depend on the details whether that's good. If they're So this scheme is, for better or worse, changes the program's priority pretty quickly. So if you were worried maybe that's too quick or I want to control how quickly that changes, you need something with a lot more bookkeeping. And there's probably been OSs that do that, but it's not the simplest thing, certainly. Does that answer your question? Yeah, okay. Other questions? Okay. So as an example, let's say here I have two processes, A and B, or two threads, A and B, and A waits for IO, does a little bit of work, waits for IO, does a little bit of work in this loop, and B waits for IO for a little bit, does a lot of work on the CPU. And we're saying initially I put them both at priority 3. Now let's say they're both newly started, so I have to guess they go somewhere, and I put them at priority 3, which has the time quantum of this much. So what's going to happen is B finishes this IO here. It's the only thing that can run. We're going to run it. And when we run it, we're going to enforce that time quantum. So as we start running it, we're going to set a timer to go off that many units in the future, which is why it gets to run for one time quantum. And then we switch to something else. And in this case, A became ready. So we're going to switch to A. It's at the highest priority. And we're doing round robin at priority 3. And also, remember our rule, B used its whole time slice, and it can still run. Therefore, our guess is maybe it should go to a lower priority, so we're going to try running at priority 2 instead. So B goes down to priority 2 and waits. Why does it wait? It's not the highest priority. I think at the highest priority is A, it can still run. When A finishes running, we're going to run B again, and A is going to do its I.O. So while A is doing its I.O., B can run. And here, well, we start B here, and we want to set a timer for its time quantum. So we set that timer, we run B, and then A becomes runnable again. And remember, we're doing priority scheduling here, and we do that, if we want priority, that means we're going to interrupt B with A. So A gets to run in the middle, which means we're going to cancel this timer. And we're going to run A. When A finishes, we're going to set a new timer. And we're going to set the new timer based on how much of the time quantum we have left. So in this first chunk here, B used this amount of time. So our second time quantum, so our second timer for B is the remaining time that B has left in its quantum. So we have to do that sort of bookkeeping. So you have to keep track of how much time they have left in the quantum, or else this wouldn't make sense with A interrupting B. B would effectively get infinite time, which is not supposed to be how it works. So once B has used that priority 2 without waiting for IO its whole long time quantum, then we demote it again to priority 1. And here it has a really long time quantum that it can't use. So it runs for a bit, being interrupted by A in the middle. And when it doesn't use that whole very long time quantum at priority 1, we bump it back up to priority 2. It does IO as it's doing IO. And when it comes back from the IO, we're running it at priority 2. Questions? So I know that the sort of confusing thing here is that, yeah, we have to do this bookkeeping about time quantums that are like done in multiple pieces for the scheme to make sense. Because if we didn't do that, then, well, B would just keep running forever, which would be pretty bad if we had anything else running like a priority 1. Other questions, comments? What happens if a new process gets added in the middle of this? So if the process is like, if we don't know anything about the process, we'll start it at priority 3, and it will get to run sort of in round robin with A, or when A is not, or if A is waiting for AO. If it's a process that was running before, like, you know, B right here, we'll run it at whatever priority we remembered earlier. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this shows sort of the operation of multi-level feedback cues, and I mentioned this is sort of the simplest scheme, so we have this sort of oscillating behavior. And there are some issues with this. So one issue that someone mentioned is we can have starvation. So that if we have something similar, a scenario where we have a long computation, you know, that uses a long CPU burst, and a bunch of things that have shorter CPU bursts, if we have enough of them, well, the thing with the long CPU burst basically won't run. Like, we'll start it at the high priority, it will go all the way down, and then all these B things that have these medium CPU bursts get to run instead. So starvation is 100% possible. So there's another issue, which is that this is gameable. That if I want to write a program that runs at a high priority in this system, I can do that by just doing I/O. If I do extra I/O, my program runs faster. Which maybe is not very desirable. So this might be something I do deliberately. This might be something my program does by accident. I just, you know, tweak something. I say, oh, I optimized my program. It's faster now. But not for a good reason. So these are some undesirable things about multi-level feedback cues. And in particular, this starvation thing is a really big issue for deploying schemes like multi-level feedback cues in practice. So there are real schedulers that are based on this design, but one of the things they need to add is something to deal with starvation. So that they'll need to do something to like detect when programs are sitting around not being able to run for a long time and fix that. Just because otherwise, for a typical like desktop system, it's very much not acceptable. And you also might want to think about doing something to prevent programs from just, you know, manipulating the system to get a higher priority than really makes sense for them. And multi-level feedback cues, there's just one way of doing this sort of notion where, well, the big thing you want to do is you want to give the benefit to interactive programs. So multi-level feedback cues are a way of doing that, getting, you know, sort of what our goal for turnaround time is. There are other ideas we could have. You know, we just need to think about, like, how can we do this efficiently? So multi-level feedback cues, they're great for doing this efficiently. We basically are doing work we do anyways to do a round-robin scheduler, right? You know, there's very little extra work involved in a multi-level feedback queue that we wouldn't do in a round-robin scheduler with a little bit of priority scheduler grafted on top. It's not much more complicated. Versus like something like if like we were like averaging over the historical CPU usage or doing like this, you know, actual machine learning or statistics, like it's way less complicated. And it adapts to programs pretty quickly. There's a question of like maybe it adapts to changes in behavior too quickly. But it's really bad at avoiding these pathological behaviors. So you could imagine designing schemes which, you know, work in different ways, which maybe look at other signals. Like, for example, I haven't looked at what programs are using the keyboard. Has it been a factor? It could be. But these are the sort of things that schedulers might think of. So that's what I'm going to talk about for schedulers that are focused primarily on optimizing sort of turnaround time or responsiveness. Next, I'm going to talk about Linux's default scheduler, which rather than being built like these multi-level feedback queue-based schedulers, including the ones that like deal with starvation, but based on sort of optimizing something like turnaround time first, is going to be built in optimizing something like fairness first. Before I move on to that, questions about sort of our heuristics for optimizing turnaround time. Okay, so we're going to talk about Linux's completely fair scheduler. So this is a proportional share scheduler. I'm going to first introduce it with the out the proportional parts to just a fair sharing scheduler. And unlike our lottery scheduler that we started with, it's not randomized. And unlike that, it has a way of doing a log n scheduling decision that is not really complicated to implement. And it has a way of favoring interactive programs that we kind of added on top of the FAIR scheduler. So rather than working favor interactive programs, then add fairness, we're going to start by starting with fairness and add favoring interactive programs on top of that. And also, it has some way of adjusting time slices that we may or may not get to. So let's first talk about the sort of key way we do non-randomized FAIR scheduling that Linux has chosen. So it tracks for each thread one number called the virtual runtime on the thread. So every time you run the thread, we increment its virtual runtime. So basically, the virtual runtime is just how long the thread has run. And our scheduling decision is we run the thread with the lowest virtual runtime. And why is this efficient? Well, we can store this with a balanced tree. We can update the balanced tree. So, you know, everything is actually log n. So what does this look like? So let's say we have programs that are always runnable. This is the boring case, but we'll start with it because, you know, it's the one that's going to be most familiar to us. So here I have programs A, B, and C, and we have some virtual runtime set from before this where they were running for a bit for some reason. So A has a virtual runtime of half a millisecond, B 1.25, C 1.4, and we always run the thing with the lowest virtual runtime. So we run A for 1 millisecond. And now A's virtual runtime is 1.5 milliseconds. And now that means that, well, A no longer has the lowest virtual runtime. Now it's B. So B runs for 1 millisecond. Now its virtual runtime is 2.25 milliseconds. Now C has the lowest virtual runtime, 1.4 milliseconds. So it runs for one time quantum. In this case, I've chosen it to be 1 millisecond. And its virtual runtime is now 2.4 milliseconds. And what we end up with is just round robin. So if everything's always runnable, we get round robin. So where things are interesting is when things aren't always runnable. If A pauses to do some I/O, what's going to happen? So let's look at what that effect looks like. So let's say here I have A running, and A runs for half a millisecond and then waits for some I/O. Let's say that I/O happens pretty quickly. So A is ready by the time B finishes. In that case, we can run A right now. So A is going to get to run sort of as a bonus for not using its full time quantum. Just because we added up its time, it's used less time. So A will get to run, and it will continue to get maybe some priority from having given up in the past the CPU more often than the other programs. So we kind of, you know, give AA credit for the CPU it wasn't using by waiting for AO. So this is a type of fairness that the lottery scheduler doesn't really do, because it doesn't keep this state. Now, there's a problem with this scheme. So here, A just waited like a millisecond to do some IO, but that's not so great if A like waited like, you know, a minute, an hour, right? Maybe it was waiting for me to press a key for an hour. The scheme would tell me that then A gets to run for an hour before B and C run. So we don't want to do that. So what will happen is, let's say that A has been waiting for I/O for a long time, and B and C have been running for a couple seconds. You know, so they're updating their virtual time, and then A becomes runnable. So what we'll do is, rather than keeping A's virtual time the same, we're going to have some limit to how much ahead A's virtual time can be of everyone else, so how low it can be versus the other programs. So when A becomes runnable, we're going to look at the other things that are runnable. We're going to say, yeah, we'll let you run before them, but like only a millisecond extra or something like that. The threshold numbers, they vary. It's a choice you have to make, but we'll choose some threshold to limit how much advantage A gets from all the time it wasn't using the CPU. And by controlling this, we can control sort of how much benefit we give to things that are waiting for input or other events. And we can see that for things that generally don't use like the whole time quantum, this will invariably mean that they sort of always get priority over everything else. So questions? So the idea is we have some advantage for not using the CPU as much, but a limited amount. So basically we just say you get either the time you had recorded before or that, or a little bit less than what the best that anything currently running has, whatever's the maximum of that. Or something like that, and we can tune what a little less means to change sort of our trade-off between how much do we want to let interactive things get priority, like our shortest remaining time first scheduler approximations do, versus how much do we want to be more like that lottery scheduler, nice and fair. Okay. And this idea also tells us, how can we deal with a newly starting program? Well, we just give it that sort of, either we give it the same virtual runtime with like no benefit rather than just a little bit, or that little benefit. I guess as a solution for that, because otherwise, like, we don't want, if we're here, we don't want to let a new thread D start at zero. That's going to be pretty unfair. So that's our, that's the sort of key idea of the completely fair scheduler. So there's some details that we probably won't get to, some we may or may not get to. So like one is like how long are the time quantums? Another is when do we preempt something that's already running? So there's some logic for that we're probably not going to get to. But the sort of key idea is we have this virtual runtime and that we have this adjustments to virtual runtime based on how long you run, and to make sure you don't get too far ahead of everyone else if you are sleeping. And the scheduling decision is run with the lowest virtual runtime, and the reason that you can actually implement this efficiently is that we aren't scanning all the threads, we just have a balance tree that we just, which is indexed. Basically, the keys to the tree are the virtual runtimes, and when we update a virtual runtime, we do a tree remove, tree insert. And scheduling is just look up the lowest thing in the tree. Okay, so for thinking a little about how this works, or I guess I should take questions on CFS before I go through to a little exercise. Okay, so do this little exercise. So here I have two programs, A and B. And let's assume that this pattern repeats forever. And let's assume we don't do any adjustments for waking from sleep. Sort of, how much CPU does program A get? About. Oh, right. And I should mention the equal weights thing. So one thing I mentioned, I said it was proportional share. How do we implement proportions? So that's actually fairly simple. We're going to do incremented by how long it runs times a weight. And we just adjust the weight for different programs. So a lower weight means that you're more important. Meaning that, if you are more important, we'll say that you run for 2 seconds, that counts only for one. But here, we're assuming equal weights. So they're both equally important. The question is how long, what portion of the CPU does program A get about? And if you're having trouble thinking about this, so one thing to think about is what would happen if program A and B just wanted to use all the CPU rather than waiting for IO over. where we should start. Okay, so let's start with a sort of sub-problem here. So let's say A and B just never waited for I/O. How much, what portion of the CPU would A get in that case? If we just had, you know, A was just use all the CPU and B was also use all the CPU. What portion of the CPUs would we expect then? Yeah, 50-50. So we'd expect 50% and 50%. Okay, so that's a useful thing to think about, that if we do nothing, like everyone's, A is gonna use one unit, B is gonna use one unit, and they're gonna kind of do that round robin training places thing. Okay, so let's, so that's from there. So we have that. So one way we can kind of go from this scenario is we can say, okay, so now what happens if I only run B in this pattern? Or actually, let's start with a different scenario, a different sub-problem first that's even simpler than that. So we have A in our pattern. So, right, that pattern. And let's say B isn't running. How much of the CPU time will I get in that case? Just A runs its pattern. Yeah, back there? Two-thirds, right? It wants to run 4 out of 6 milliseconds. So this is two-thirds. And how about if we did the, how about if we did the same thing for just B alone? Like if we run B without A, how much of the CPU time will it get? Yeah. Sorry, what? 24%? 40%. Okay. Yes. So 40% of the time. Or 2/5. Yeah. So B running alone would use 2/5. A running alone would use 3/2. And that's the most they can use. So that's a useful thing to know. is that B can only use 2/5 no matter what else is running, right? That's the most B can use. So something we can say is that if A and B are running together, the most A can use is 3/5. Or not the most A can use, sorry, the most B can use is 2/5. Right, and the most A can use is 2/3. So those are some bounds. So our question is, where in the range? So we now have a range for how much time A could possibly use, which is sometime, some amount between, you know, 0 and 2/3. But if we think of, if B's running alone, it uses 2/5, that means there's 3/5 left over. So during that 3/5 time, either we're running A, or we're running A's IO. Okay, so we have this. So anyone have from this any insight into like how we figure out about how much time A gets? And then we have some work here. Or some estimate of how much time A gets. We're probably not going to get an exact answer because it depends exactly how the IOs overlap, but we can get some estimate from this. Yeah. Sorry?
I charted out the first 10 milliseconds.
Okay.
And I got that A used about half the time.
A got about half the time? Okay. So you said it seems like about half the time, so you just chart it out manually. Yeah, so that is one approach we can use here. We can kind of chart this out, and that sounds about right. So a reasoning I would use is that if B can only use 2/5 of the time, what's its virtual time going to look like? And if you charted it out, what was B's virtual time at the end? Was it higher or lower than A? It was lower than A, and it's going to continue to be lower or equal to A because of how the scheduling works, right? We always run the lowest virtual time. And it makes sense that it's lower because B can't use half the CPU time. It uses less than that. So effectively what's going to happen is that this is going to be sort of B, you know, once less than half the CPU, so implies B has less virtual time than A, usually. Than A, which implies B runs at higher priority than A. So in effect, the effective schedule is basically going to be that B has higher priority than A all the time, just because it's less greedy for time. That A generally wants to use more CPU time, and B doesn't. So B ends up always having a lower virtual time, and gets higher priority. And it never manages to catch up to the amount of time A is using, because A gets to use over half the time, and B uses much less than half the time. So we end up, A gets 3/5 minus the amount of time it's doing IO that overlaps with B's IO. Questions on that sort of rough reasoning, and the exact reasoning is, you know, just chart it out. But the sort of big pattern is, oh, B never really catches up to A. Sorry, did you just take the fairer? Yeah. So the question is, do we take the fair? So the way I reason about this sort of abstractly is that B and A are entitled to half the time. So first we give them that, if we can, and then we split up what's left over, right? So we give B half its time, half the time, we try to, and it takes up 2/5 of the time, and now we split up that leftover 1/12 to A. Or not one tenth, sorry, to A. So A ends up with using 6/10 of the time. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that's where we'll finish up today.